Hi, I'm Andy Reid.
And I'm Mike Porter.
You're listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations, which is aired on the third Wednesday of each month from 2 until 3 p.m. on WGXE Acre 90.7 FM.
On each show, invited guests will be asked to discuss a number of items that they intend taking with them on their Catskill Cabin getaway. As we discuss their chosen items, it is hoped that you, the listener, will enjoy getting to know that person a little bit better. Today's guest is Phil Potak. Phil spent his proverbial Wonder Bread years on the Great South Bay, Long Island. He then spent his McSorley's years on the Lower East Side. His focus in adulthood has been marriage and fatherdom, an ongoing endeavor. Phil is a director and writer. He is also a talented actor, although Phil maintains that he is not an actor and will fight anyone who says differently. His interests include dogs, beekeeping, and cocktails. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You will have to explain to me McSorley's years.
Okay, McSorley's Old Ale House on the Lower East Side of Manhattan is the oldest bar in New York, I think, or maybe the second oldest. All they serve is McSorley's Light, McSorley's Dark, and Coke.
Okay.
Sawdust on the floors. I've gotten drunk at every table. When you buy a beer, you have to buy two at a time. Because in the old days when I was there, in McSorley's years, one beer was 75 cents, two was $1.25.
Oh, yeah.
So, it's math.
It's economics, yeah.
It's just economics, yeah. So, but it's just, it's a great place that everyone from Lincoln, I think, to Dylan Thomas, you know, got drunk there. Well, maybe Lincoln didn't get drunk, but but he should have. He should have.
You know. And if he did get drunk, I bet he hit his head going out the door.
You'd win that bet.
Yeah. Knock his head off.
So it's still there then?
It is. It is, yeah.
So when's the last time you were back?
It's probably been a couple of years since I've been there, but I go in there, I know when to go in, and there's a man now working who was sweeping the floors as a boy, and he still remembers me, and you know, he treated me and my family very, very well when we were last there, and he said, yeah, there's some people we'll always remember. So, but I literally went there every day and worked on my writing drank beers before I went to work, which was waiting on tables in those days.
So you floated through work?
I did. I mean, you know, have you ever waited on tables?
Actually, I've never waited on tables.
Yeah, sometimes you have to float in order to deal with that. I maintain that I think everyone should, if they're going to go out to dinner, should have to have been a waiter first.
Wait. Now, your first song is Moondance by Van Morrison.
Yeah.
Why did you choose Moondance?
Well, first of all, I love Van Morrison. And Moondance, it's one of those songs that's special to Don and I. We have, when we ask each other, if someone said, do you have a song, you know, a song for the two of you? I asked her this once. And I said, write down what you think is our song. And we each wrote down two songs. And we wrote down the same two songs, and this was one of them.
Well, the one was the Ramones.
You were talking to my wife before the show, weren't you, Andy? So I just, you know, Van Morrison, to me, has written so many great songs. And, you know, I mean, some people say, oh, Phil, that's kind of a cheesy choice. But, like, I don't care what they say, because I think it's a beautiful song, and I love to dance with my wife to that song.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance, with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance, neath the cover of October skies. You know the leaves on the trees are falling, to the sound of the breezes that blow. You know I'm trying to please to the calling of your heartstrings that play soft and low. You know the night's magic seemed to whisper and hush. You know the soft moonlight seems to shine in your blush. Can I just have one more moon dance with you, my love? Or can I just make some more romance with you, my love? I wanna make love to you tonight. I can't wait till the morning has come. Yet I know now the time is just right, and straight into my arms you will run. When you come, my heart will be waiting to make sure that you're never alone. There and then all my dreams will come true, dear. There and then I will make you my own. And every time I touch you, you just tremble inside. Then I know how much you want me that you can't hide. Can I just have one more moon dance with you, my love? Can I just make some more romance with you, my love?
Ivan Van Morrison, the maestro himself from the Emerald Isles. Fantastic song.
Ah,
great choice.
Thank you for playing it.
Have you ever watched the Last Waltz?
Yes.
So you'll know the performance when Van Morrison played on it.
Yeah.
And he finished his set and he just dropped the mic to the floor and just walked off. Like a true class act that he is. That was a cool moment, I must admit.
That's a long time ago. I'd like to see that again now that you remind me of it. Yeah. Yeah.
That's when he was vaguely good looking.
Ah, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, Andy.
Have you ever seen him, Van Morrison, live?
No, I'm sorry to say.
That would be something to behold.
It would.
And there's still plenty of time. So... Oh. The next chance you get, you need to do it.
I will. And I'll call you up.
And then after that, after the show, you need to take your wife for a nice plate of paella.
Paella.
See, he's upstaging me with the pronunciations here. Paella. Sounds like somebody vomiting after 10 pints. But paella.
You make it sound so appetizing.
Now, paella. Paella. The word derives from the old French word paella, the word pan, which in turn comes from the Latin word patella for pan, as well as patella is also known, akin to the modern French poêle, Did you know that?
I did not know that.
I didn't know the root of paella either.
No? But pan I get because paella is a party in a pan.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
Do you like it?
Well, I've seen some of these massive big pans, you know, like yes. Especially in you go to the one that comes to mind for me is in Edinburgh. They do this in Scotland. They do this big market just off Princes Street, and it's people from Europe, you know, obviously from Spain and Portugal and stuff like that. And they have this stall where there's this pan that's like 7 feet wide,
wow.
circumference, and it's just this big plate of gumbo yellow yeah. rice with shrimp and vegetables, and it's
chorizo.
It's just yeah, gorgeous looking.
It is.
Have you ever tasted paella? I'm struggling with this word.
I haven't. I haven't tasted it, but my only experience with it is the Coyote and Roadrunner cartoons that I watched when I was a kid. Usually the coyote is this bumbling idiot who always ends up catapulting himself into the side of a canyon. But in one of the...
Acme.
Pimples everywhere.
Me.
But in one of the episodes, so he's this complete dolt, but in one of the episodes he has like this really fine, sophisticated accent, and he gives the audience this lecture on why he loves Roadrunner so much, and he brings down this diagram that has the Roadrunner split up into all the different sections of the animal, and he's like, this tastes like apple, this is like, you know, rump roast, and this part is like paella. And as a kid, not ever having had paella, I was like, I thought it was a fruit for the longest time. And it was only recently, maybe a few years ago, that I was like, oh, it's a whole dish, not a fruit.
And obviously you can have some vegetable and fish and meat dishes.
Right. I mean, there are traditionally always peas in it. Mm. And, you know, some, you know, red pepper. Yeah, that was one of the dishes my mother made. Even though she made it in an oven and made it a little bit differently, she turned us on, you know, to paella. You know, and this is in an era in a family that, you know, it was all really about, you know, meatloaf and mashed potatoes and corn, or, you know, roast, or, you know, just sort of the most fundamental food. But little by little, she would turn us on to things like paella, you know. She'd use American sausage as opposed to chorizo, and it would be her version of it, but nonetheless. That's one of the reasons I chose that, because aside from the fact that if I'm going to be alone with only four things and you're not going to provide anything, not including food, why would I not have chorizo and in my paella, you know?
Your next item, Phil, is a bottle of 18-year-old Elijah Craig. Not a bottle of a human, but a bottle of bourbon.
Right. Elijah Craig bourbon, the 18-year-old, yeah. Well, again, you know, having only four choices, what goes better with, you know, paella than, you know, and I have to last the whole weekend, so I can't just get a bottle of nice wine.
Now, is it a bourbon?
Elijah Craig is bourbon, yes.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And where would one get a bottle of Elijah Craig?
That's an excellent question, Andy, because they're so hard to get. The 18-year-old is very difficult to acquire these days. First of all, it's only available every 18 years. And secondly, you know, it's coveted at this point. So I hear, you know, it's right now, when we used to get it, it was reasonable. Now it's probably a couple $100 a bottle.
Is it made in like Kentucky?
Yeah. Mm.
It's touted as the oldest single barrel bourbon in the world. And I read that the barrels actually lose 2/3 of their contents in what's called the angel share.
The angel share, yeah.
And what is that? What is this angel share?
The angel share is where, and I'm a layman at this, but the reason I'm cutting in here confidently is because I watched a movie called The Angel Share in Scotland. And basically, when the barrel is sitting for so long, inevitably there is a loss of fluid in the barrel and evaporation, and they call that the angel share. It's because it's been given up to the angels.
Wow.
Yeah. And that happens in all whiskeys.
So if we could devise some type of device that could capture said angel's share.
You deprive those angels of a really good...
party. you'd probably get, you know, punished in a later life. You know, remember that angel's share.
They're already in heaven. They're fine. And this brand was actually named in honor of Baptist preacher Elijah Craig, who lived 1738 to 1743, born in Virginia, became an educator, an entrepreneur in the area of Virginia that ended up becoming Kentucky. And that's one of the ways that we have this Kentucky bourbon, this legacy of distilleries in Kentucky. The distillery claims that Reverend Craig invented the process of aging the bourbon in oak casks, but this isn't really certain. Oh, and food, for any who are interested in what Elijah Craig, the 18-year, tastes like, food critic Morgan Murphy said, "Apple and caramel on the nose and a peppery rye finish at the back of the throat makes this autumnal brew a game day winner every time."
Well, autumnal.
Is it autumnal? I think autumnal.
Autumnal? I would say it's seasonal. Yeah. All four seasons.
Yeah.
Speaking of the seasons, your next song is going to be Spring by Antonio Vivaldi, part of the Four Seasons suite.
That was seamless, Mike.
Hey, I do what I can.
Well done, well done.
Why Spring?
Let's start with why Vivaldi, maybe. Why Spring? Because I love the Four Seasons. I love Vivaldi. When thinking about what songs I would want.
See, when I was growing up, the Four Seasons was a hotel.
It was a band when I was growing up. But, I thought about what I would want to listen to in terms of variety, and I chose Spring. First of all, when you live in the Catskills, you really look forward to spring.
Yeah.
One does, anyway. One normally looks forward to spring. And
well, apart from last year when it was quite a mild winter. So,
But generally speaking, it was mild last year. So I look forward to spring, and it's just a beautiful piece of music, to my ears. I mean, I love winter too, the piece, the Vivaldi piece, not the season. I do enjoy winter, I'm kidding. But, so I chose it because I love the strings. I love Vivaldi. I love the fact that, Vivaldi wrote that, and it was considered at the time a schlock piece for the people. And it turned out to be just one of the most, played pieces, of all time. One of them.
Thank you. Thank you.
that was Spring from Vivaldi's Four Seasons. You're listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations on WGXC Acra 90.7 FM. Today on the show, we have Phil Potak with some paella.
Beer.
Some Elijah Craig.
Bourbon.
Some bourbon. And we've got a couple of things.
Spring, Van Morrison, Vivaldi, and also a leather man.
Now, I'll be honest, I don't know what a leather man is. Is it a leather man?
No. You were waiting to say that. You know, it's like a utility knife.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's like advanced Swiss Army knife kind
right,
of thing.
Right.
They're awesome. My father-in-law got me one, and the thing is like, it's the ultimate MacGyver accessory.
Perfect way to put it.
Yeah.
You know. Mike has a crack knife that you never... No, I tell a lie. It cuts sausage with it.
Sometimes. It's for backpacking. It's a Gerber blade. So it's this, just an awesome, sharp, semi-serrated knife that I never use because it's so awesome.
I want to dull it. Yeah.
So what would you use this knife for, well, this leather like, man?
You know, it's better to have it and, you know, not need it than need it and not have it. That's right. The thing just about a leather man. You know, so it's a pliers and a screwdriver and a knife and a scissors and, you know, all of the things right. wrapped up into one. And if, you know, my sense was that if I'm going to be alone, one never knows what's going to happen. One's going to have to, you know, pull out the MacGyver head and try to fix. And I've thought that, like, you know, I have only four things to bring.
Yeah.
One of them better be something to fix something that goes wrong, you know, as opposed to trying to just use my, you know, phalanges.
As Phil wrestled with the bear, he struggled to get the blade
out. Man out.
He struggled to get the blade out, but thankfully the screwdriver twisted the bear's nipple and he ran off.
Better than him staying with the pliers.
Oh, man.
Oh, heaven. Did you guys...
You're not here for the hunting, are you, Phil?
Did you guys see the Revenant?
Oh, yeah.
Leonardo DiCaprio. Oh, gosh. We were talking about that today, and that is just the most guttural, rough movie. Great. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I saw it on a plane. It was fighting a tiger or something, wasn't he?
A grizzly bear.
That's what it was, a grizzly bear.
Yeah.
Ugh.
He was like buried alive and stuff.
Yeah.
We're just ruining this movie for people. Somebody's listening to this show just haven't been to Redbox.
Oh, thanks.
Driving home.
I saw actually.
He lives, by the way. He lives. Just sorry.
Terrible. Just terrible. Somebody is now turning around to go back to the Redbox. I saw a black bear crossing the road just the other morning.
Yeah.
On the way into work, yeah.
And just to get to the other side.
Yeah. That's all he did.
Cigarette and. Glasses on.
He waved at me. He had a cup of coffee, and no, that's another story. That's when I was going to work, and the three ducks passed a lady on the sidewalk like they were on their way to work too. They walked right. They walked in opposite directions. A lady and three ducks just passed each other. I was like, okay. But this bear actually, I pulled over and stopped.
First, where?
This was in Greenville.
Right
next to the. There's a pond in the
duck
center
pond.
Of town. Yeah, there's a duck pond. You know, runoff pond. And there are ducks living there, and I'm just.
They call it a waddle off pond.
So I'm driving through town, and this lady's walking on the sidewalk, and I look, and these three ducks in single file just walk right by her. They pass each other in opposite directions.
And they were like, "Morning."
Yeah. So anyways, this bear, I pulled over to look at this bear and try to get a picture, and he ran down into the ditch, up into the woods, and as I stopped, he stood up and kind of looked at me. And then he kind of did this like jumping around maneuver and ran away.
Do you know what was happening when he was doing that?
Trying to see me?
No, he was singing, "I'm the king of the swingers."
Oh, it's Baloo. Do you have any encounters with bears where you're at, Phil?
We do. You know, occasionally, you know, I have bees. I'm a beekeeper, and so obviously the honey attracts them. And one time, a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago. My wife Donna and our daughter Katie, they were doing some painting on the outside of the house, and I was mowing. I'm driving down. Of course, they've got music blasting, and I'm screaming because there's a bear, you know, like 15 yards from them, like nosing around, and so, you know,
was it up on its hind legs and doing that? Woo-wee-doo.
It was, and but you know, it's sort of daunting when you see a bear moving close to your family. You know, like it sets you, you know.
While he was on the moor and he was shouting at them, three ducks went by him, and one of them went, Aflac!
Phil, your next song is Smile by Nat King Cole.
Yes.
Why Smile?
Well, first of all, Smile... Do you know, it's Nat King Cole's version of Smile. Okay, do you know who wrote Smile?
Smile was based on an instrumental theme used in the soundtrack from the 1936 Charlie Chaplin movie.
Oh my God,
movie,
you've done your homework. Yeah, because
Modern Times.
To me, I could bring in so many things. Charlie Chaplin wrote the music for this. I believe John Turner, I can't remember, Parsons, Jeff somebody Parsons in the 50s wrote the lyrics to it. You know, so bringing Chaplin into the cabin, if you will. And having Nat King Cole. Nat King Cole is probably my favorite crooner from when I was a kid, you know, being turned on by my parents to the singers of their era. You know, there was Nat King Cole and the Johnny Mathis and Sinatra and blah, 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 blah. But I loved Nat King Cole. And so I love Nat King Cole's version of Smile. I love the lyrics that was added now that you know, we all now know is Smile. And, I just had to hear that, you know, on this weekend.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by. If you smile through your fear and sorrow, smile and maybe tomorrow you'll see the sun come shining through for you. Light up your face with gladness. Hide every trace of sadness. Although a tear may be ever so near, that's the time you must keep on trying. Smile, what's the use of crying? You'll find that life is still worthwhile if you just smile. The time you must keep on trying. Smile, what's the use of crying? You'll find that life is still worthwhile if you just.
Nat King Cole, Smile. But we move on to your next item.
Unbelievable, you saved this for last.
And what is your last item?
I have to say it?
Oh, yes.
It's toilet paper.
The first documented use of toilet paper in human history dates back to the 6th century in medieval China. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
And throughout time, wealthy people used to use other things as opposed to toilet paper. I'm going to read out a list of things that people used to use in order to clean up. people would use wool, lace or hemp. Less wealthy people used their hand when defecating into rivers, or cleaned themselves with various materials such as rags, wood shavings, skelves, leaves, grass hay, stone, sand, moss, water, snow, maize.
He said huskily.
Ferns, many plant husks,
sorry, Donna.
Fruit skins or seashells and corn cobs, depending on the country and weather conditions of social customs. Now, Joseph Gaty. Do you know who Joseph Gaty is?
No.
Were you trying to look over my shoulder there?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. Do you know who he is?
I wanted to see where this was. No, I don't know.
Do you know who he is?
The name sounds familiar. He invented... Go on.
Well, go on.
I want to say he invented the toilet, but I don't remember. Ahead, tell me, please.
He was credited for being the inventor of modern commercially available toilet paper in the United States,
okay.
Which was first introduced when? You looking over my shoulder?
Yeah.
When was it invented?
So he knows.
1857.
There you are.
It was a Sunday. It was a rainy day. I remember it well.
4 years before the beginning of the Civil War.
It was widely available in late 1920s. So there you go.
Now, your last song is The Long Road by Cliff Eberhardt with Richie Havens. Why that song?
Well, you know, Cliff is my oldest, dearest friend, and he's a fabulous songwriter. And so if I'm going to be, you know, in this cabin on for a weekend alone, I would definitely want to hear, you know, one of Cliff's songs. I chose this song because Richie is so important to Cliff. And, you know, having Cliff introduced me to Richie one time at a concert, and, you know, I had an opportunity to spend some time with Richie. And he's such a fabulous person, and his voice works so well with the song. And I just have there's so many great stories that Cliff tells about, you know, about the two of them together when they toured in Europe, and it's just it has impact on my life, the song and Cliff, and you know, and Richie too, you know, and so that's why I chose the song. I had to have a Cliff song.
My dearest friend George George Patterson, who stays in London, soon to be staying in Scotland again. George, actually, George is the writer of the theme music for this show, and George wrote a song called Richie Havens.
Really?
Because he's such a Richie Havens fan, and he sent the song to Richie Havens, and Richie got back to him, and the two of them struck up a, you know, correspondence.
Nice.
And stuff, and Richie was playing, and George sent him some more of his music. And Richie was playing in London, and George went to see Richie playing, and he went backstage, and he said to somebody, I'm here to see Richie. And Richie came out, you know, and George wasn't expecting, you know, he was just maybe expecting some pleasantries, you know, but Richie came over and gave him a big hug.
Big hug, that's Richie, yeah.
Gave him a big hug and says, George, you know, and then he turned to the rest of the bandmates and he said, this is the guy's music I've been letting you hear, you know? And George was just blown away.
Oh, man, that's so Richie.
Yeah. George was on our show a while back, and he played some of Richie Havens, the song. Mm. And I know the song very well. So when we're finished here tonight, I'll make sure I get you a copy of the song.
Oh, that would be great. So, that would be great. When I first met Richie, you know, Cliff and Richie were playing at this theater. I don't recall the theater, but it's just on the other side of the Tappan Zee Bridge. And they're doing a sound check when, you know, Don and I came in and Katie was with us. And they just stopped, and Cliff was like, there's Phil, you know. And Richie, like, stopped, gets off the stage, comes down, and I'm like, this, you know, this big man comes and he just grabs me and just bear hugs me, as you say, you know. And I was, it was spectacular. And I, of course, I go to put my hand out to shake his hand and stuff, you know. And he's like, he grabs me and he's like, you know, you're Cliff's friend, you know. And you know, before the show, we sat backstage and he told his version of Woodstock from Richie Havens' perspective.
Wow.
The entire story of like tapping with his foot and waiting and like having to just play and go on and the delays of people getting in with it was just to hear it from him. It was amazing. And he was just, you know, he's an amazing fellow, and it's not surprising that he so embraced Cliff, because Cliff is amazing, you know, and he's such an amazing songwriter. And you know, so anyway, that's why I had to choose this song, because of Cliff.
There are the ones you call friends. There are the ones you call late at night. There are the ones who sweep away your past with one wave of their hand. There are the ones you call family. There are the ones you hold close to your heart. There are the ones who see the danger in you and won't understand. I can hear your voice in the wind. Are you calling to me? Down a long road, do you really think there's an end? I have followed my dreams down a long road. Long ago, you are the one who saw my dream. You are the one who took me from my home and left me off somewhere. Somehow I feel you are here. You are waiting in that dream. Somewhere down this road we will awake and be at the start again.
Down the line.
that was Cliff Eberhard with Richie Havens, The Long Road. Fantastic song. Beautiful vocals there, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. They
You're listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM. I would like to remind listeners that we are a community-based radio station. If you like listening to our shows, or indeed the radio station, please consider contributing anything that you can in order to keep this beautiful radio station on air. Thank you.
And you can do that at wgxc.org. Phil, we're coming to the end of the show, but there's still a couple things we wanted to talk about here, and one is theater. We want to talk about Richie Havens first.
I was going to tell you that story about Cliff.
Cliff.
We spoke, if I may.
Yeah.
You were asking, and we started talking about it before, but, years ago, when we were living on the Lower East Side, Cliff was writing and performing, and he got a call one night. He wrote this song called White Lightning. It's a great song. And he got a phone call, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning or something. And he said, and it was like, "Hey, Cliff." It's like, "This is Bob Dylan. I wanna, talk to you about your song White Lightning." And
at 2 a.m.
Yeah, and Cliff, thought it was one of his, friends and said, "Skippy, stop it, man." Bang, hangs up, A minute later, the phone rings. "Cliff, wait, man, don't hang up. This really is Bob Dylan." So, and in fact, it was Bob Dylan, and he wanted to talk about one of his songs. And so, they started having this, sort of friendship, and Cliff would go and jam with him when he was in New York. And I guess, Bob had a huge concert at Madison Square Garden, and his people, whatever, called up Cliff and said, Bob would love you to come to see the show. There'll be a ticket waiting for you, and he really would like you to stop by afterwards and say hello and stuff like that. And Cliff was like, "Okay, sure. are you kidding me, man?" So the show goes on. Afterwards, Cliff goes back and. Cliff, you need to hear Cliff tell the story, but he walks back and said, Cliff and Bob said to stop by. And so he walks into the back into the green room, whatever it is. And there's sort of Bob sitting on his throne like thing, "Oh man, Cliff, come on in, And so Cliff comes in, he's like, "Hey George, this is my friend Cliff. I've been loving his music. He's the guy I was telling you about, I was like, Cliff, meet my friend George." And Cliff turns around, and it's George Harrison.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm like, and so funny, because when Cliff talks about these songs, he talks about his experiences, and they're like, there's so many of them. The Cab Calloway story I was telling you about when he was with Richie in Italy and stuff. But, he talks about Bob Dylan. I said, "Cliff, you always forget that, he introduces a George Harrison." I was like, "Oh yeah, I should add that in my repertoire." You're right. He did introduce me to one of the Beatles.
Wow.
A monumental moment.
Yeah, not kidding. Yeah,
Phil, let's finish up the show talking about theater and your writing. When did you first get into writing?
Well, I got into writing. So many years ago, but I got into writing because I started, and I know we're going to have a fight about this, but I started as an actor. I quickly realized that when you go on a cattle call and you're online with a bunch of other actors, acting going on the line, talking about who we studied with, blah blah blah, than on stage. I used to say if we had this much great acting going on the stage, the theater would be in a much better place. But so I realized when you're on a cattle call and you're going for this one role, there are 200 guys a little bit more handsome than you, a little bit taller, a little bit thinner, much better teeth, and I realized maybe this is not for me. Plus, I realized directors sort of call the show and they create schedule, and it's it's all about scheduling things. So I'll be a director. So I also wanted to be a director to see what problems actors created, so I wouldn't be one as an actor. So I was sort of experimenting with directing, and then I realized you still have to depend on the actors, even as a director,
Yeah.
But you can pick them.
You can pick them, but you still can't control them. They're wearing a cardboard belt. Anyway, so I've always been interested in reading, and I've always been interested in words, and so I thought that as a writer, I can completely control one part of this artistic, you know, world, you know. And so I was drawn to, and I'm drawn to characters. I watch people, and I'm drawn to characters. I'm drawn to books. I'm drawn to words. And so it just became inevitable that I, you know, start writing plays because of my love of theater. And I realized, like, I'm sort of a so-so actor. You know, I think I'm an okay director, but, you know, it's the words that sort of, you know, means so much to me, and like choosing the right word for that character. And as we were talking about before, Mike, you know, whether or not, you know, I use a contraction here or not, you know, all of those things matter to me. So it just seemed like an evolution, a natural evolution for me to go from one to the other, to finally to writing.
Now, would you choose a word specific, you know, would you choose one word, a descriptive word, based on that particular character? So say, for example, you had Mike in a play, you knew that that word, that descriptive word would fit Mike's personality, as opposed to if it was me, you'd maybe choose another word.
No, I don't think about the actors when I write the play. I think about the characters. And so, you know, from my perspective, like, you know, when one hears a character speak, you know, one should be able to tell to a certain extent a little bit about their entire history by the way in which they, you know, express themselves. You know, so whether or not, you know, they have one level of education or another level or no level of education, or they're from a certain part of the country, or they have a certain cultural background. So it's all based on the character, the words that I try to choose,
right,
you know, to have that person, you know, accurately and succinctly express themselves, you know. So it's not about afterwards, I think, what actor could do this. And I having worked with Mike, there are so many times when
I'm sorry about that.
Well.
Come, Andy? It was a great time.
You know, we've had some fun times together, Mike and I, you know, theatrically speaking. And so he's a fabulous actor.
Well, thank you.
Great voices and a very good sense of timing. And it's all about the timing, as we all know.
And, well, Phil, you're a brilliant writer. And having had the opportunity to act in a staged reading with a show that you wrote, not only a great command of language, but also a brilliant understanding of relationships and how to portray relationships in a way that really, I think, cuts through to the heart of the emotion that people feel, whether it be, you know, total ecstasy and exhilaration or disappointment. I remember the twist of the one show, spoiler alert, but husband and wife can't conceive, so the brother steps in, and then the husband dies. And just a brilliant turn of events, and it was great.
Well, thank you.
It was such a wonderful time.
Do you have any shows coming up in the pipeline?
I don't, not right now. I mean, for the past couple of years, I've taken to doing readings myself, you know, because, as I said, you know, one of the things...
Monologues?
No, not monologues, but me reading multiple parts. And recognize, and actually it was Cliff's idea. It was like, Phil, you know, you know the nuance. You know when not to overplay something. Just read them yourself. And, you know, there are, you know, the downsides to not having, you know, an audience, like, see the different characters read. But the upside is I can take the show anywhere, you know.
Yeah.
Just read the parts and, like, yeah, I know it's flawed a little bit, but aren't we all? And... You know, and
it's art, so.
And read all the different parts myself. I mean, I've read a 13-part play. I try not to write such big character plays anymore. That was one of my earlier works, you know, where I was like, I need all these characters, you know. No, you don't, Phil. Cut it down. You know? So I don't have anything upcoming. I'm working on stuff actually that's not even theater and not even a play at this point. I'm working on something a little bit different. And, you know, someone that you might know too, a buddy of mine, another writer, said, I'm writing this thing, and I don't want to call it a memoir, but I'm not quite sure it is a memoir. It's so overused. I'm like sick of the word memoir almost. But I said, you know, I don't know why I'm doing this. It just sort of felt right, and I don't know if this is the kind of writer I am. You know, and he was like, but you don't know that. You might be.
Yeah.
You just very well might be. And I was like, You know, Mike, you have a point. His name is Mike also, yeah. So, so I'm not working on anything right now, but I'm always working on something, and I'm always jotting down notes, and I'm always sort of taking things in, you know, in hopes that, like, they're... Because brilliance comes from the oddest places, from, and, you know, you never know when you're going to find or hear something that's like, you know, like, oh my God, that was so poignant, or that was so perfect, or whatever. You just never know.
You know, I was talking to a past guest about that. You know, he was talking something similar, and he was saying, you know, he'd maybe come up with a song, doesn't know where it's going to fit, but 3 years down the line, that song may be ideal for something he's written. And it's like a big jigsaw, isn't it?
It is. Perfect way to put it.
It's like, right, that fits in. Yeah. Might not fit in just now, but it might fit in.
Right.
5 months.
Rarely it fits in right now.
So, you know.
Yeah.
So, well, good luck in the future.
Well, thank you.
Look forward to seeing some of your next work.
Thank you,
and it's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Oh, it's been a mutual pleasure.
Loved it.
Thank you,
loved
both.
It. And,
thank you both.
Thanks for bringing Eagle Rare.
Well, I wasn't going to spend the money on the 18-year-old for you lugs. You know? Actually, I would have if I could have found it, but you're more than welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you, Phil. Now, we have one more question,
okay.
And you've already kind of answered it, but okay. It is...
No, partially.
Partially. How do you take your coffee?
With raw honey.
And that's it, raw honey.
Yeah, but what type of coffee?
Oh, I'm not going to do a product placement right now, but it's going
to... No. You strike me as a... you know, nice, expensive coffee.
Well, thank you. but
he drinks Folgers, so.
No,
sorry.
I mean, I'm going to just come right out and say it's Starbucks. We crush our own Starbucks coffee.
All right. So is it, what kind of roast is it?
It's usually a dark roast, French roast, you know.
Right, that's what I drink, French roast.
Yeah.
So you like it strong then?
Absolutely. Why drink it otherwise?
Yep.
Strong with honey in it. Yeah. That's my type of guy.
Yeah.
Well done, mate.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate that. Oh, even more now.
Thanks again, Phil.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Andy.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Phil Potak, and you've been listening to Catskill Cabin Conversation on WGXC Acra 90.7 FM. Special thanks to George, Gordon, and Billy from the band White for their theme music, and to everyone at WGXC